Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. In the last 20 years, the number of the world's poor has dropped significantly. It's due to a combination of free trade and, to a lesser extent, development aid. In this program, we will hear from two key actors who work to advance the development agenda. We'll start with my recent conversation with Jim Kim, president of the World Bank. And we'll then go on to hear from Luis Alberto Moreno, who heads up the Inter-American Development Bank. This event was recorded as part of our Global Philanthropy Forum conference. And now to our conversation with Jim Kim.
So let's start on the topic of trust. What is striking to me when you look at the Edelman Trust Barometer, the most precipitous, the most sudden decline is in stable democracies that have opened and connected their borders. Say something about why and what role globalization has played in that.
Well, if you take a global view, globalization and trade has had a huge impact in terms of lifting people out of poverty. So in terms of global trends, before 1820, basically everybody was poor, tied to their land, except kings and queens, royalty. And everyone was basically poor. 1820, the Industrial Revolution, and between 1820 and 1990, for 170 years, the share of income of the G7 countries went up steadily for 170 years. And then only in 1990 does it start to drop. So what happened around 1980, 1990, probably the most important thing was that that China embraced the market system. And if you go there, I mean, it used to be when I was in grad school in the 1980s, every Chinese person could quote from the Little Red Book. Not anymore. I mean, everyone quotes Deng Xiaoping, who said things like, "To get rich is glorious. Some of us will get rich first." And in comparing the market system to planned economies, he said, "I don't care if the cat is black or white as long as it catches mice." And so there was an explosion in growth in China, and they lifted 800 million people out of extreme poverty. And that has been repeated in many, many different countries. So that was because of China's openness to trade. They actually allowed their state-owned enterprises to face competition. And just these extraordinary things happened. And the overall share of global income for the first time for the G7 countries dropped. So I think what you're seeing is very real. People are saying that globalization hasn't worked for me. And you know, there's good data on how lower middle class, working people in the OECD countries, their incomes have gone down. But it's very personal for me. I grew up in Iowa. And in Iowa, only 10% of us went to college. And of the 10% of my graduating class that went to college, about 90% of the 10% went to community college. And my friends, who I played on the football team with, looked at us and said, "So you guys are paying to go to school more? I got a job in the steel mill. I bought my first house. I bought my first big red truck. What on earth are you thinking? Why would you go to school? And why would you continue to go to school? And then why would you pay for it?" Right? So these people's lives now, steel mills have closed, of course, and these people's lives now are not better than their parents, and the prospect of their children's lives being better than theirs is pretty low. Now, I know all this because I'm on Facebook with all of them now, right? And caught up. And so this anger is real, right? But there's some things that that if you talk to Roberto Acevedo of the World Trade Organization, he would tell you that at most 20% of job loss in advanced economies is due to trade. 80%, and probably more than that, is due to automation. So these jobs are not coming back. And if they do come back, you're going to have a different set of skills. Now, we've never, in the United States anyway, taken that skills agenda seriously. At the World Bank, it's one of the most important things we do to try to help prepare people for the economy of the future. But one of the keys to productivity, one of the real keys to productivity, of course, is innovation. And innovation will increase productivity, but it will probably take jobs away. So this is an issue for every single country in the world. And in my own view, being against globalization is sort of, you know, fighting the windmill. You know, it's a pretty quixotic kind of task, because even if the European countries and the United States begin to look really intensely inward, it doesn't mean that China, Japan, Korea, all of East Asia are not going to continue to aggressively build trade relationships with Africa, with Latin America, with South Asia. That's going to happen no matter what. And so looking inward is really the worst thing, I think, that the powerful OECD countries can do. But you're right, Jane, there is a very strong anti-globalization mood. Now, my own sense of it is that that will continue until it becomes quite clear that that anti-globalization mood is not shared by the rest of the world, and spaces start getting filled by others as the OECD countries pull out. I don't know where this conversation is going, but what we're trying to do is just bring the reality of how the global economy works now to people. I mean, you know, things like, I think there are some people who would say, the U.S. should be self-sufficient, we can close all our borders. The extremists say that. If that were to happen, we've actually done the calculation, if we were to just close borders and stop trade, I mean, it's hard to imagine, but if we were to do that, the purchasing power of the bottom 40% would go down over 50%, right? So there would be a very rapid impoverishment of poor people, and, you know, wealthy people would, you know, would do as well as they always do. So from my perspective, in terms of our mission, which is to end extreme poverty in the world, globalization has to increase, and we have to get even more intense about figuring out how every single country will fit in to the global economy of the future. And that's a really, really difficult task, because automation, while automation is going to have an impact in the United States, it's going to have a much more devastating impact in developing countries. Two-thirds of currently existing jobs in low- and middle-income countries will be gone because of automation. Yeah.
I'm going to take you back to your classmates who you're on Facebook with. You noted that we haven't taken the skills gap seriously enough here. If they were asking you today, why are you going on to more school and paying for it, they'd be asking you, why are you borrowing to go to school to pay very big for it? And what we know, what we've seen about globalization, is those divisions are along educational lines, right? It's not just skills, but higher education in general. How do we make education, advanced education, tertiary education, both more accessible from a financial standpoint and more relevant to the economy that awaits?
Yeah, you're taking me back to my previous life. In developing countries, we look at education much more. We have to look at education much more holistically, because it starts, literally, it starts with the health of women and the nutritional status of women, and then it moves to the pregnant woman, and then it moves to children, and especially the first 1,000 days. Because if you don't get those pieces right, no matter what you do with the educational system, you're going to be in trouble. I mean, the issue that concerns me most right now is the extremely high levels of childhood stunting in some really important countries. I mean, I literally was shocked to find out that Indonesia has 37% childhood stunting. And so when I went there, and in my first meeting with President Widodo, I said, you know, you have this is like a medical emergency. Unless you start moving quickly, you know, they have aspirations of being a high middle income country in the next, you know, decade or so. And I said, how on earth are you going to compete with as much as 40% of your workforce of the future? And stunting levels were probably higher in the past. The low-skill jobs are just not going to be available to absorb this kind of workforce. So they started working intensively on stunting. But I don't know if we're going to be able to catch up, because if you... what we know for sure is that every single neuronal connection you can have is going to be critical for countries to be competitive in the future. India, 38% childhood stunting, 38%. And I'm in an argument with the Indian government right now about whether this is real or not. And in the mid 2000s, the World Health Organization did a study and took children from all over the world and found that every single child in the world, if they're adequately nourished, can grow 25 centimeters in the first year and 12 in the second. Every single child. Your ultimate height might depend on genetics, but those first 2 years, it's uniform across the world. And so, one of the economists was arguing with me, saying, no, this is not real. Indians are just shorter. And it's not true. It's not true. And so Pakistan has close to 40%, Guatemala 50%, Ethiopia 50% stunting. Across Africa, around an average of 40% childhood stunting. And so we have to start there. But then, of course, we also have to improve the quality of education and then have access to higher education. And we've invested quite a bit in improving the quality of higher education in Africa. But I think the great struggle that we all have to engage is what is going to happen. If artificial intelligence, robotics, automation, it's happening much quicker than anyone ever thought, right? So just 2-3 years ago, I had an argument with our chief economist. Will garment manufacturing always require low-skilled, low-wage labor? And he said, it's impossible to do that with robots. And I just met a woman who told me, we're so excited about our new factory in Haiti. We're making high-end couture T-shirts and garments for the Canadian and the U.S. marketplace. And she says, and, you know, the only downside of it is that we're doing with 3D printing. And what we learned is that Haitians are capable of running the 3D printers, but of course, the number of jobs is much less than 2 years ago. I was arguing with economists about whether 3D printing would have a role in garment manufacturing, and now in Haiti, it's already happening. I'm painting this picture because I think it's very real. And at the same time that automation and artificial intelligence, these things are running ahead of what anyone thought, the other phenomenon we're seeing is that in developing countries, people who have access to the internet are happier. They like having access to the internet. But what happens, and we actually did a study based on some of the Gallup surveys. I had a group of my economists actually look at this. What they found was while people are happier if they have access to the internet, what happens is that their reference income goes up, meaning the income to which they compare their own goes up. And so for people to maintain the same level of satisfaction, their own income has to go up at least half as much as the reference income. And if you're poorer, it has to go up like twice the reference income, their income to feel satisfied. And so what you have is, on the one hand, technology is taking away jobs, but technology is also leading to what we call a convergence of aspirations. Aspirations are rising. So what do we, the thing that I'm working on is trying to give everyone, at the World Bank Group at least, a sense of just enormous urgency in tackling the situation we face in front of us. And of course, my great worry is with 38% stunting in India, about 40% on average in Africa, with low-skilled jobs going away because agriculture, light manufacturing is all becoming more capital intensive and more technology intensive. What are these people going to do? Because the one thing they probably will have is smartphones with access to the internet. So all in that process, their aspirations will be rising. Now, we have a plan. So we have a plan and we have an approach. But this is what keeps me up at night.
I'm going to take you, because you spoke a good deal about the physical health of children and how that's sort of set in the first years of life, to the emotional health. We're learning much more about toxic stress and the conditions, sort of a lifelong affliction coming from endemic poverty, war, it can be dislocation, it can be very much what our world looks like right now. So what does this mean for the development agenda? What is the role of economic development and of philanthropy as well when it comes to the issue of toxic stress?
So the three things that cause childhood stunting. So first, of course, is malnutrition, but also lack of stimulation. So early childhood development activities are critical. And the third is to remove children from situations of toxic stress. And so We had a very a generous replenishment of our IDES, $75 billion over 3 years. And we're going to double the amount that we spend in fragile and conflict-affected states. And so we feel that attacking fragility and conflict is really, really critical. But we also feel that you have to go upstream, because there's so many countries right now that are sort of pre-conflict, pre-fragility, violent situations. And so the urgency to bring economic development to these poor countries, I think, has never been higher. But if you look around, OECD DAC just came out with the official development ODA figures, and the numbers are higher. But the numbers are higher, at least partly, because if you spend money on refugees in your own country, it counts as ODA. And if you look at the philanthropic dollars going to Africa and low-income countries, that's actually gone down. And we think that's a secular trend. That's going to continue. So in the context of jobs disappearing, the internet increasing people's aspirations, what do you do? And so I just gave a speech at the London School of Economics really focusing on how partnerships are critical. And I know you're talking about it here. We believe that there are some very, very positive potential win-wins in the world. The biggest one is that so many owners of capital are earning very little return, and they're looking for higher returns. And so we need to be able to create situations where the sense of risk and the sense of return that they'll get on their investment, but also the sense that they can make an investment, they can put their capital in a debt instrument or even in equity, and earn a very good return while also having a huge impact on development. We think that's the great potential win-win situation. Now, we've done it in bits and pieces. We've done some really interesting things in bits and pieces, but we haven't done it systematically as a group. So what's happening right now in development finance is that if there is some wonderful low-hanging fruit project, something that's very easy to finance, all the development banks and even all the bilateral donor agencies compete for it, right? But it's those very projects, the low-hanging fruit projects, that could be financed completely on commercial terms. And if you finance them completely on commercial terms, what it does is it frees up budgetary space for the countries that then they can spend on things like investing in children. So we're trying to move toward getting all of the development finance institutions, and you might ask Luis Alberto about this because he's not so hot on this idea. It's going to be tough because we're going to have tremendous discipline that instead of undercutting each other to, you know, because if you do project preparation and there's this great project that really looks easy to finance, what we do now in the multilateral development banks is that we run to the board and try to get it passed right away so that we get credit for our loan. Getting money out the door is the key. And what we're saying is, no, if you do such a great job of preparing your project that it becomes commercially viable, that's the biggest reward. You get huge amounts of credit for doing that. It's like you have provided the entire whatever $500 million for the country, and we'll give you credit for that. So we're changing that right now, and hoping that it will shift the conversation. But of course, everyone has to shift, because if we step back and then everyone else jumps in and takes those projects, that's not going to work. This is the right thing to do for poor countries. It's the right thing to do for the world, but it's not how we've behaved. So much of development finance has been like little cottage industries, where the priorities of individual organizations has been more important to the people inside it than what's happening in the world. And I'm arguing that we don't have that luxury anymore. The urgency of creating jobs, of trying to bring everybody into the global economy is just, it's so great right now that we've got to move together and agree on kind of an ethical approach that we won't undercut each other, but instead try to maximize support for these countries, so that there'll be more money to do critical things like invest in health, education, social protection.
So you've just talked about where the money is. Let's talk a little bit about where the needs are, because what the World Bank is about is long-term development, that can be sustained over time, that's inclusive. But meanwhile, we have crushing down on us, famine perhaps in four countries. We have the refugee crisis. We have these immediate crises. And the question is, what role has the bank played in those? And what role can it play without, in essence, taking away from the long-term mission?
Right, right. Ebola, for example, my friend Raj Punjabi's here, who was working in Liberia at the time. It's not our role to respond to pandemics. The World Bank had never been involved with pandemic response. But about 8 months in, you know, it started in December of 2013, and I had just been hearing news reports. But over the summer, you know, in June and July of 2014, I started hearing news reports, and you know, my friends at MSF were Joanne Liu was on the, you know, on CNN saying this is so much bigger than we had ever thought. And I finally called Paul Farmer, the person I've worked with for years, and Paul said to me, "Jim, there's just so much virus out there. We've never seen anything like it. We don't know if we can stop it." So I went to my board on August 4th of 2014, and even though we'd never done this before, I got the board to approve $400 million within a day, and then we moved money within 9 days. And you know, it was other people who stopped the outbreak. But what we were able to do is we brought enough attention to the issue that soon after the U.S., U.K., and others jumped in. But we were the first. We were the first to make a commitment. And you know, we put I think close to $2 billion into those three countries. But we knew that that was not sustainable. So what we did was we asked a question. We said, could we potentially put a bond and an insurance policy together so this never happened again? And this had never been done before. There had never been a pandemic insurance policy before. But we talked to the reinsurance companies, and the reinsurance companies were saying, "Oh my God, thank you so much for talking to us, because this is one of our biggest risks." And it's not just the life insurance policies that they hold; it's the business disruption policies, and these are the reinsurance companies. So we brought them all into a room. We brought infectious disease specialists, we brought modelers, and our own teams, and we came up with an approach where, when certain milestones are hit, when certain parameters are crossed, the money from this insurance policy will automatically disperse. And there's also a cash window to whenever anything is suspicious, we have cash to send people out there right away. So in December of 2013, when the first cases were reported, our hope would be that that cash window would send money out right away, along with WHO. But certainly, well before money finally started to move, the insurance policy would release. And so if the insurance policy had been in place, it would have released at a time when the epidemic was 10 times smaller than when money finally started to move. And so that's what we should do. What we should do is use every one of our skills. So for famine, we're so far the largest donors to the famine effort, $1.6 billion. And again, this is not what we do, but there was no money flowing, and so we stepped up. But the thing we're looking at now is, how do we prevent famines in the future? Because as Amartya Sen taught us, you know, many decades ago now, famine is not about food. It's about politics. It's about conflict. And this time, it's about climate change. So there's plenty of food in the world to respond to the famine, but lots of complex things are going on in those countries. And so what we're doing as well is to really look at ways to prevent famines going forward. And I'm not sure what kind of financial tools we'll be able to come up with, but that's our role. And you know, for refugees as well, we're trying to go upstream. We're trying to say, how do you create a thriving economies in places where there's active conflict? So we're in Yemen right now. You know, we don't have a physical presence in Yemen, but we're working through the UN agencies to try to see what we can create now, even before the conflict is over. We're trying to create, we are creating special economic zones in Jordan and Lebanon so we can create jobs for Syrian refugees and Jordanians and Lebanese. So this is a big change for us in the last 3 or 4 years, that we've jumped into the global public goods world much more than we ever have before.
And of course, conflict-affected countries are where the poor now live.
Yeah, more than 50% by 2020. Yeah.
So that says that
more than 50% of people living in extreme poverty will live in fragile and conflict-affected states.
So as you think about the role of development in the conflict continuum, has your perspective on that changed?
I think, in my view, it's even stronger. And I think that those countries that are going to lose 60-70% of their currently existing jobs, with high rates of childhood stunting, with increasing access to the internet, I think of many of those countries as literally pre-conflict countries. It's coming, and so we've got to figure out how to use technology in a different sort of way. And I think there are lots of positive things too. I mean, I was just in Rwanda, where for the first time in history, they're using drones to deliver blood. It's extraordinary. It's really a wonderful innovation. I think that. One of the things we're going to have to do is to increase the number of formal jobs in health education and even social protection, or just the sort of the empathy care professions. I think that's going to increase. And so in Rwanda, we're looking at taking the 45,000 strong community health worker force that's been volunteer so far with incentives and really turn it into formal employment. For 45,000 people, because what we know is that the health outcomes will improve. You could potentially drop childhood stunting rapidly if you had a formal workforce that was focused on it. And I think those are the jobs of the future. And by dropping stunting, by improving the health of people, by providing the kind of both technical and soft skills that they'll learn from being in a formal job, I think that the contribution to economic growth will more than make up for whatever cost it is to pay the workers. I think those are the things that are going to happen. I think formalized professional daycare, for example, to allow women to enter the workforce and provide really professionalized care for children is also going to be a growth sector in the future.
So why don't we open this up for questions real quick. Go over to you.
Good morning, Peter. To everyone. Thank you for this very inspiring speech. And
I feel like it's been very dour and very,
really.
But it's what we see.
No, it's very inspiring. So Jane, what I wanted to ask Jim is really about this, stunting that you mentioned, because in the developed country, a lot of social workers would agree that not the malnutrition, but the other two, the toxic stress and the lack of attention, are really common. So would these two allow for stunting as well?
Absolutely, yeah. Looking at height for age is really useful because it's so easy to do, right? And we can measure that. But if you look at the brains of children who have been adequately nourished but either had no stimulation or been in toxic environments, they suffer the same problem, which is literally they have fewer neuronal connections. And you can actually quantify how many fewer they have. So, human capital is literally the number of neuronal connections you have. And these children will never catch up academically. And we have study after study after study that shows that their income is lower in the future.
President Kim, I'm Natalie Bridgman Fields with Accountability Council. Good to see you. A question related to our themes of trust and legitimacy. We have an issue with the World Bank's accountability framework having a legitimacy crisis, where the International Finance Corporation claims that its own accountability office's compliance findings are not true. They're debating the findings. How do we bring this full circle in helping civil society have trust in the World Bank's agenda when its own compliance findings are debated by the institution itself?
I don't know which particular case you're talking about, but there are many very complicated, difficult cases. I mean, let me give you a perfect example. Many NGOs are very upset about the fact that we invest in financial intermediaries, and they've been very critical of us. But I would strongly suggest that you look very specifically at the projects and you look very specifically at what we're trying to accomplish with the projects, right? There are lots of cases where, for example, we invested in something. We've been out of it for 10 years, or sometimes, you know, shorter than that, but anywhere from a year to 10 years later, we are held accountable. And the reason that we're held accountable is because there's no other mechanism to hold anyone accountable for those kinds of issues. So lots of cases are ongoing, and I know that there's a whole group of people just like you whose job it is to hold us accountable. And I just think you have to take it case by case. So I don't. And let's look at the case of financial intermediaries, right? So we could back off from putting any money into financial intermediaries, but what that would mean is that small entrepreneurs, families in Uttar Pradesh, in India, who want a mortgage to buy a home that's literally $500, right? Then we would not be able to move capital into those kinds of situations if we didn't work with financial intermediaries. And the argument is that if we move any money into financial intermediaries, we should use our safeguards with everything that they do. And so that is logistically extremely difficult. And so the trade-off always is, well, do we provide, you know, poor people in Uttar Pradesh with mortgages, or do we not? Now, I mean, if you want, at some point, I can talk to you about individual cases, but let me put it this way: this is really difficult. This is the most difficult part of the job, because we have, on the one hand, developing countries who are extremely angry that our environmental and social safeguards are so strict. And the argument they make is that when the rich countries were developing, there was no such thing as environmental and social safeguards, and we're held to a different level of accountability. Now, I'm telling you, I hear this every single day. Every single day from the middle-income countries and lower-income countries, they complain about the environment and social safeguards. On the other hand, from the OECD countries, there are groups like yours that give us exactly the opposite argument. So my job is to try to keep going in terms of trying to address the urgency of the development challenge that I told you about, while tackling difficult issues. One of the things that we did over the past couple of years is we brought discrimination against the LGBT community into the language of the safeguards. Now, there are 90 countries in the world, maybe fewer now, in which homosexuality is illegal according to their national laws. So how do you get anti-discrimination against the LGBT community into the safeguards when just about half your countries think that homosexuality should be illegal? Right? We did it because I forced the question, but that's the nature of multilateralism. Right? You have still just tremendous complaints from the low-income and middle-income countries, and then you have groups like yours who are holding us accountable. So this is my life, right? This is my life, managing the complexity, and I wake up every day feeling that not only are we doing the right thing most of the time, but that the task is ever more urgent. Let me just put it to you bluntly: if we do not, as a World Bank group, dramatically increase the amount of private capital that we can bring in, and be in the middle of it. The reason we need to be in the middle of it is because the owners of private capital don't have safeguards going into these countries, and our client countries are expecting us to play the role of honest broker, making sure that development outcomes are prioritized first and foremost, and then we bring in the capital based on their priorities. Right? That is my most urgent task right now. And I can tell you that as many criticisms as you may make of the World Bank Group, if we don't do that, the final common pathway for many, many countries is going to be fragility, conflict, violence, extremism, and eventually migration. Right? That's what is happening in the world today, and we have to live with the imperfection of being a multilateral.
Peter.
Peter Laharn, Conrad Hilton Foundation. Jim, I understand that one of your taglines these days is moving from billions to trillions. Given that foundations are now moving maybe from thousands to millions, and there's only one foundation that grants more than $1 billion a year, I assume you're here not for our quantitative contribution. Can you tell us what you think foundations should contribute to this agenda?
So, and Peter, thanks for asking it, because you know exactly what I'm going to say. So here's the proposition that we're bringing to you. The World Bank, the thing that I probably spent every day doing is learning more and more and more about how the rich use the most fancy tools to make themselves richer, right? Hedges, swaps, guarantees, commercial paper. They use so many different tools to make themselves richer. With very little of their own capital, they get huge loans that they then invest, turn over, and then make a lot more money, right? And so I didn't know much about this when I first came to the World Bank. But then the question we've been asking is, how can we use the tools of the rich to benefit the poor? So the pandemic insurance is a perfect example, right? So nobody ever asked the question, can we insure the poorest countries against pandemics? But that's what we do. And so we came up with that. Now, the proposal I'd like to make is that we have different funds. If you're interested in refugees, we have something called the Global Conceptual Financing Facility. And it's a facility where if you give us $10 million, we go to the capital markets and raise $40 million. And because we have the lowest borrowing costs in the world, that's the whole trick of the World Bank Group. We have lower borrowing costs right now, just barely, than the U.S. Treasury. So we can go out to the capital markets today and get a 15-year maturity loan at 2% fixed rate of interest. And so if you come to us and say, well, we have $10 million that we want to put into this particular issue, refugees, or if you wanted to do children's health, we have another fund that does it for children's health. We'll take your $10 million, we'll go to the capital markets and raise $40 million, turn that into a $50 million fund, 20-year maturity, 20-year payback at 0% interest, and then we'll work with you to try to get the outcomes in the country of your choice. So in other words, we'll turn your 10 into 50, and if you ask most countries, what would you rather have, $10 of grant money or $50 million of 20-year money at 0%? You see, rich people get money cheaply and pay it back over time in 20 years' time. Let's say we give $20 million. In 20 years' time, you're paying $1 million because you divide it up into 20 one-year payments with zero interest. In 20 years' time, $1 million is nothing compared to the impact that the $20 million can make today. That's how capitalism works. And we are ready to work with you to make your dollars work in wherever country you're thinking about at literally five times what you would have otherwise, right? And the other thing is we're looking to go upstream in a lot of different areas. You guys are innovating in ways that we're not as capable of, because so many of you are on the bleeding cutting edge of innovation in many areas. So we'd love to talk with you. The reason Matt Damon is coming is they built this wonderful organization called water.org, and they're using microfinance institutions and local financial institutions in just the most interesting way. And they're coming because we're trying to take that to scale. We couldn't have come up with that on our own. We never could have done all the legwork to put something like that together. But financially, it makes so much sense. It's linked to a social impact bond. It is just the coolest thing. What we're going to do with them is take what they're doing and try to scale it very quickly. So it's an open invitation to all of you. I mean, I hope you feel that the World Bank over the last, 4 or 5 years has been much more open to working with all of you, because, we are the leveraging machine. We can take your money and stretch it, and we can also work with you to follow a project over time to make sure it gets the outcomes that you're looking for.
Go ahead.
Hi, thank you. You mentioned the importance of capital owners getting return on their investment. And my question was, on a species level, in the long term, is continuous economic growth sustainable? And if not, what will replace it?
So
Let me just start by saying species-level questions are always very difficult. But it's the right question. It's an extremely good question. And so here's what I think. As a species, how are we possibly going to get ahead of climate change? And I worry about this every day. I worry about this every single day. Now, again, you know, we're a multilateral institution. So India, China, all of Africa tells me that why are you punishing us for the carbon that was put in the air, not by us? You know, we have a right to develop. We have a right to, you know, be able to provide jobs for our people. And frankly, I'm compelled by that. I think that there are certain things that we just absolutely have to do in order to survive as a species. And one of them is to get a price on carbon, right? Because I don't think that there's anything about the political negotiation process. I don't think there's anything about voluntarism that gives me a sense that we're going to be able to move quickly enough to stop ourselves from destroying the planet. I mean, right after this meeting, I'm going to meet my buddy David Chang from the Momofuku chain. He's putting, you know, an all-vegetable burger that bleeds, right? So, there are things going on all over the place that are going to try to help us survive as a species. But my own conclusion after, you know, having been in graduate school and studying every pre-Marxian and post-Marxian, you know, thinker in the world, right, I've come to the conclusion that unless we get the incentives right, we are not going to be able to develop the technologies that will save the planet soon enough, and a price on carbon is critical. So we're now the largest funders of climate change-related activities, and we've got a huge carbon pricing effort. But here's how I see this, again, after so many years in the job. If you're going to read one speech, read Xi Jinping's speech at Davos, right? He stood up and he said, I'm the head of the largest communist party in the world, and I'm here to tell you the global market capitalism is the ocean we all swim in, and any effort to turn it back into lakes and rivers will fail, right? And he talked about innovation and trade. So if there were a better way, and if you have an idea of a better way of organizing the global economy, I'm happy to hear it. But what we're trying to do is to try to make it work for the poor, make it work for the planet. Let me just give you a quick bite about what we're trying to do. We're trying to make natural capital accounting so clear and so quantifiable that we're going to include it, for example, in the IMF's Article 4, which is the assessment of a country's ability to pay back loans and survive. We're going to try to come up with a human capital index where we take stunting and educational outcomes and apply it so rigorously that it will start affecting decisions on foreign direct investment, and it will even start affecting, we hope, someday, borrowing costs. Because we're not going to get heads of state, ministers of finance, to do the right thing until it hurts. If you don't manage your carbon output and you don't manage your environment well enough, your borrowing costs are going to go up and foreign direct investment will go down. If you don't invest in your people sufficiently, same thing's going to happen. We're not there yet, but that's the big project that my team's working on right now at the World Bank Group. I've read every utopian philosopher in my anthropology graduate studies, right? And I don't see another plan other than aggressively and like an activist working to make the global market system work for the poor, work for the planet, work for women. And the thing is, if you get it right, things can just take off in a way that just never happened with planned economies. Now, things can take off in a bad way as well, but that's our job. Our job is to try to bring concern for the planet, concern for the poor, concern for women into every single discussion. I do it at the G20 finance ministers' meetings. I do it at the G20 leaders' meetings. And now it's sort of predictable, you know, that I'm going to be the one who talks about these things. And I'm not going to stop. No matter who wins whatever election, you know, I'm not going to stop talking about these issues.
You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. We just heard from Jim Kim, president of the World Bank Group. Next, we'll hear from Luis Alberto Moreno, president of the Inter-American Development Bank. President Moreno will reflect on the need for increased investment in early childhood development. This event was recorded as part of our Global Philanthropy Forum conference.
At the IDB, at the Inter-American Development Bank, this forum is an annual opportunity for all of us, not only to reach out, but more importantly, to learn from others in this very unique community. So every year, Jane and all her team do a fantastic job of really highlighting not only global themes, but more importantly, challenges that call for action. And I'm delighted that the topic this year that you've selected is the child, because as we all know, this is an area of focus that certainly we have at the bank, but more importantly, is something that is truly an impact on development. And as such, I'd like to take this opportunity to discuss with you not only the well-being of the children in our region, which is Latin America and the Caribbean, which is fundamentally our area of work. As everybody here understands, the experience of children during the critical initial phase of development will have tremendous repercussions throughout their lives and across all of our societies. And with this in mind, I would like to explore and talk to you about what it means today to be a child in Latin America. There are about 50 million children under the age of 5 in all of Latin America and the Caribbean. In broad terms, these kids today have a much brighter prospect than those who were born a generation ago. Infant mortality, for instance, has fallen by 55%, and a child born today can expect to live 8 years longer than those that were born in 1990. These kids will almost certainly live in a home with a home that has access to safe water, since the penetration or the coverage has risen to about 96% of the total region's population. And they are more likely to grow up in a middle-class household, even though one generation ago, half of them lived in poverty. They will be part of smaller families, as the fertility rates have dropped to 2.1 births per woman from about 3.2 births per woman just in 1990. And finally, they're more likely to learn to read, to write, and to do basic math, as primary education today is basically universal and preschool enrollment is every day expanding. That said, if we look more closely, our youngest children still face immense challenges. They will grow up in the world's most unequal region in terms of income distribution. Those born into families on the bottom rung of the middle class are unfortunately vulnerable to falling back into poverty. And in 9 out of 10 infants under the age of 3 continue today to lack access to formal early childhood development services. Now, the latest statistic is particularly worrisome because of what we know about the impact of proper nutrition and early stimulation during the first 1,000 days of life. If we don't fix this, the huge gap between the haves and the have-nots in our region is likely to continue to expand. And not only that, this is where all the elements of violence are bred into a child. So we'll find it increasingly harder to catch up to countries that are far ahead of us in terms of developing and investing in their human capital. So how can we turn this situation around and effectively empower our region's youngest citizens? First, we can encourage governments to ramp up their spending on early childhood development services. In recent years, countries have devoted more resources to preschool, but we still spend too much on older kids. In fact, for every education dollar spent on children under the age of 5, more than $3 are spent on children age 6 to 11. So there are cost-effective solutions, such as sending social workers on home visits to train parents or how to properly stimulate their children. Jamaica, for instance, obtained remarkable results on a very interesting pilot project back in the 1980s, and now Brazil wants to do many of the lessons there at a massive scale, potentially reaching millions of their poorest children. Second, besides the expansion of coverage, we have to strive for quality. And we must improve teacher and also caregiving training so they can provide meaningful and effective services. If not, we'll just be warehousing our kids. We did a big study in Ecuador that showed that a great number of teachers can make a huge difference. In fact, being exposed to an exceptional teacher can even help kids overcome the negative impact of a bad teacher. Third, we must emphasize the critical nature of relationships, whether they're at home, at a daycare, or at a school. Building a positive bond between the child and the caregiver, as we all know, is essential. This investment will pay off in cognitive development, benefits that will last well into adulthood. And fourth, and perhaps more importantly, we have to take action. And there's not a country that won't solemnly swear that early childhood development is their top priority. Yet it often seems to be an orphan issue with no one having overall responsibility for its proper implementation and supervision. This lack of ownership leads to poor coordination among government agencies, which in turn hinders the quality of services and produces poor results. And this doesn't exempt the rest of society from shouldering its share of responsibility. Now, we all must do our part. Citizens can contribute not only by holding governments accountable, but also by championing early childhood development. Companies can provide and or subsidize quality daycare services for their employees. Foundations can also help to pilot innovative alternatives. And universities can carry out research that helps expand the knowledge of what works and what doesn't. And we can all do more to push gender parity, especially to promote greater male involvement in child rearing. That, certainly for Latin Americans, will be a big revolution. Now, these forums, second theme, which is about trust, really resonates with us at the IDB, as it weighs heavily not only in economic but equally in social and institutional development. It's pretty settled that trust is the driver of economies, as countries with high levels of trust tend to experience higher and more stable growth. And there's plenty of research by economists about this very issue. Unfortunately, in our region, is the only one in the world where trust continues to decline. In fact, Latin Americans have less trust in public institutions than they did, say, 2 decades ago. Yet while the recent wave of uncovered corruption scandals throughout our hemisphere will probably weaken that trust in the short term, I'm positive that in the long term they might lead us to better outcomes and to a rebuilding of trust. And in that context, I truly believe we're in a turning point in Latin America where no longer societies are willing to ignore dishonesty and corruption in government. And that message is every day coming loud and clear, as we are largely a middle-income society that not only has middle-income spending habits, but more importantly, middle-income or middle-class values. And the challenge, therefore, will be to transition from the reactive protest that we witness almost daily in our streets to really addressing the root causes of corruption by building more inclusive and transparent and public institutions. We at the IDB devote billions of dollars every year to this very cause and to supporting the kinds of institutional reforms that can make precisely that difference. That sounds like a lot of money, but we think it's not enough. That's why we value partnerships so much. And just as trust is essential to engaging constituents, it is critically important to engage partners as well. Because once we establish that trust, there are no limits to what can be achieved by working together. Now, let me give you some examples of how we have built trust, and more importantly, collaborated with partners to promote early childhood development. Karen Spencer, who will speak later, I know, in this forum, leads an organization called Whole Child International. With support from another IDB partner, the government of Korea, Whole Child has piloted new effective and low-cost approaches to improving child care in Central American orphanages. Not only did this partnership engage caregivers, they also worked with government officials and administrators, raising awareness of the importance of evidence-based practices. In another example, we worked with Shakira. You all know Shakira, I'm sure, and the Alice Foundation to recognize outstanding individuals and organizations in the field of early childhood development. And in a broader alliance, we have involved the Gates Foundation, the Fundación Carlos Slim, and the government of Spain, who have backed a very interesting results-based financing mechanism to encourage countries to improve maternal and child health care. The strong partnership we have built with these actors has done a great deal to improve the lives of families across Central America, directly benefiting over 1.8 million women of reproductive age and children aged less than 5 years, while indirectly benefiting an additional 4.5 million people in this region, but more importantly, concentrating in the poorest 25% of the region. Now, that example is where trust was a key ingredient to making this partnership work, and more importantly, to allow innovation to occur. Change can be, as we all know, a scary thing. And certainly in the public sector, we all know how risk-averse they are. So it's very important for us to find partners precisely willing to take the chances on new approaches. Over the past year, we have been working closely with the FEMSA Foundation, the Open Society Foundation, the Maria Cecilia Soto Vidigal Foundation, Porticus, Promotora Social, among many others, who think about how we can collectively build trust and generate innovation. Specifically, we're looking at how to finance new approaches that will allow us to scale up solutions in key aspects of early childhood development, from improving service quality to training parents, to mainstreaming early childhood development into traditional health and nutrition spaces and plans that can generate better data and research on these topics. And as you can see, we have much more work to do. In many ways, we're still a very young region, a region full of promise and opportunity. But we'll have to work much harder to make this true for all of our children. Making quality early childhood development universal is the key to this success. And that, of course, should be our goal. So I want to again thank you all for giving me the opportunity to come here. And certainly I look forward to many of your discussions and, more importantly, to successful partnerships. Again, thank you very much for having me.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a nonprofit membership organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. Please visit us at worldaffairs.org. This program featured Jim Kim, president of the World Bank Group, and Luis Alberto Moreno, president of the Inter-American Development Bank. This broadcast is made possible weekly by the generous support of Chevron. Our recording engineer is Johnny Good. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.